Greet each of you in Jesus' name this morning. Jesus is the head of the church, which makes him our authority as we follow him. He's not just a good teacher, but he's also the one that holds the last say. Probably shouldn't call him the boss. That's almost too crude. But I think it's important that we remember this truth about Christ, that he is the head of who we are and what we are trying to be and where we want to ultimately end. It will go through Christ, and it's in his name that I greet you, but it's also who we want to spend a little time talking about, because he had some things to say while he was here on earth that are very important for us to follow. Open your Bibles to Matthew chapter 7. I want to look at the last few verses of the Sermon on the Mount. They are very, very familiar verses to us. So familiar that even as I read them, you'll probably be able to tune out and think about something else and still know what I'm reading because you know them so well. We have songs about these verses. We have many referrals. And yet Jesus was doing some very, very deep teaching about what it means to follow him and what it means to be part of his organization, his church. Let's start with verse 21. Not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father which is in heaven. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in thy name, and in thy name cast out devils, and in thy name done many wonderful works? And then will I profess unto them, I never knew you. Depart from me, ye that work iniquity. Therefore, whosoever heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them, I will liken him unto a wise man which built his house upon the rock. And the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew, and beat upon that house, and it fell not, and it was founded upon a rock. And every one that heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them shall be likened unto a foolish man which built his house upon the sand. And the rains descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew, and beat upon that house, and it fell, and great was the fall of it. And it came to pass, when Jesus had ended these sayings, the people were astonished at his doctrine, for he taught them as one having authority, and not as the scribes. You could look at Luke chapter 6, verses 46 to 49, and you would have Luke's version of the same thoughts. And we might look at that in a little bit, just to pick up some additional points to the story that Jesus told to teach us. And I think there's some details over in Luke that are worth thinking about. But this is the Sermon on the Mount. People have labeled it, and I think they're right, they've labeled it the greatest sermon ever preached. It's great because it's so compact. You can take the Sermon on the Mount and you can write whole books on it. Matter of fact, people will write books just on the Beatitudes right up front. And they'll take each one and they'll talk about it in depth. And yet Jesus, with all of his mastery in teaching and his mastery in storytelling, his mastery in preaching, communicating truth, he would say, blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are they that mourn. And the truth was coming down to these people and their mouth was dropping open. They never heard somebody preach like this. So compact. It's broad. It covers many practical subjects. Subjects like personal holy living. Subjects like how to get along with other people and what you do if you're not getting along with other people. Subjects like how do you react when evil men press themselves upon you. And you can go right down through chapter 5, 6, and 7. How to have clean and pure relationships with other people. Matter of fact, I gathered in reading through this again that primary theme of the Sermon on the Mount is basically relationships with God and other people, which is the first two commandments. But there's many things to learn about. And Jesus is the one that is preaching. Now, when I point out that Jesus said this, I need to tell you that not only is Jesus the best preacher that ever rose up, he was the best preacher. Way back in Ecclesiastes, the Bible would say, now whatever you find to do with your hands, do it with your might. And that's exactly how Jesus lived. He did everything in a mighty way. Even though it says he walked down the road, the people would flock to him, and this huge crowd would come with him. And he was mighty in what he did, but he was constantly about his Father's business, and you must understand that about him, because his life was not defined at all by his own agenda. Not at all. You know, we wrestle with this question of what's prosperity. I wonder what Jesus would say prosperity is. His life demonstrates that he believed that prosperity was nothing more and nothing less than doing what God told him to. That's it. Now there's prosperity. Well, Jesus did his Father's will. In other words, he obeyed. He did the things at will of his Father. He did what he was supposed to do. And I think you can understand when I make this point that when we start talking about obedience, there is a certain kind of quality that you can give to obedience. At least in our own thinking, there's a difference between the obedience of the man that said to his father, "I'll go work in your vineyard," and never did. Well, that was a lip service that didn't amount to, as we say, a hill of beans. He never went. But there was also an obedience where a man said, "No, I won't go." And then he went, and he was judged to be obedient. Now, that is obedience, but it's not the best because it's flawed with rebellion mixed in the midst of it. But when you come to talk about the obedience of Christ, it's the purest obedience that there ever was. He could not have done it better or another way and have it be more obedient than what he did. He just did his Father's will. And if we measured his obedience by the standard of gold, you would give it 24K. If you measured it by the purity of water, you would give it 16 megohm. It's just pure. He did it. And he calls us to the same thing. And he ends up his whole sermon with this story about people that are building houses, and the one is a disaster and the other is a success, and it's contingent. It all comes back to how much the builder, well, in the story, it's how much the builder invested in a foundation, and in real life, it is in how much the builder obeys. It's too simple. But it's a common teaching. And he makes the point that right knowledge is an essential knowledge. You have to know before you can do. I will tell you that there is little to none righteousness that happens in societies or cultures or neighborhoods where there is not truth. And all you have to do is go into the ghetto or into the third world country, the Central Americas, the places where the people have false religions. And you watch it, what that does. And America has her own false religion, and it is the god of, well, what shall we call it? Humanness, selfishness. It's not organized into something like Muslim faith or Hindu or Buddhist, but it's just simply, I will be my own god, humanistic. But when you have that, you're going to have very too little, no righteousness happen, because the people don't actually have the knowledge of what is right. The knowledge that they have is twisted by another god, a false god. And in those situations, when people come out of that into the truth, you will hear them saying things like, "I used to be in darkness and now I'm in light." And all I'm saying here in this point is that it is important for us to understand that truth before it's practiced is first known. And that's why Jesus had this whole sermon, so that the truth would be known. And now he has given it, and he starts talking about, will you or will you not do it? And he talks about this phenomenon that was going to happen, that he foresaw happening, and is going to be a group of people that show up at the end of the story, at the judgment day, and they will be using the same tool that they've always been using to declare their compliance. Only it was a joke. They'll say, "Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name? Have we not done many wonderful works?" And he says, "I will not answer that question. I will simply make the point that I don't have a clue who you are. But we prophesied. We taught. We forecasted. I don't know you." And without the obedience, the truth does not close the loop. Truth only closes the loop when it is done. Well, here are these people. And then he comes to try and illustrate the point that he's trying to make. He gives an illustration. And we're all the same. If the preacher puts a story to the point, it sticks. Okay, I get it. And so he tells this story about houses and storms and rivers and floods, and crash, they go down. I heard this passage used for a devotional on Wednesday evening, and it just got me to thinking. I thought back to how the children would pick this song every night at Bible school this year, and it kind of stood out. And as a family, we tried to figure out what was up with that. Was it just peer pressure, or why did they do that? And well, no, it's a song, and yes, it is repetition, but it is punchy, and we got these actions, and the people get into the action, and they really gear up for that time when that house comes down, and the whole group crash, and it sticks, and we like it because it makes a point. Really came down with a crash, and it did. But the other reason that I've been mulling over this is something that came to me a couple weeks ago. It might be 2 months by now. I think I told some of you about this conversation I had with another bishop, where he talked about somebody that had fallen into a very deep sin, in what we would judge to be a very serious moral sin. And he said he can't understand it, because he said, I've heard the man teach on that subject, and he said he could enlighten me on points about how moral purity works, and here he is. And I said to him, I said, well, I guess you know that particularly in our circles, most of the sin that happens to people that already know better. There's practically none that I know of that I face in church leadership that comes to people, well, they had no clue that the Bible ever suggested that might be objectionable. But the majority of it comes to people who skip their foundation. They know that if you don't have a foundation, it'll wash out. But somewhere in the soul, we're in the heart, in the throne room where decisions get met, there is a core decision that's made that says, so what? I'll do the other thing anyway. And that's somewhere between baffling and almost sickening, to know that capacity is there. And really, when you go back and look at this Sermon on the Mount, and Jesus ends up with this story about houses that stand in storms and houses that fall flat, what he's telling us is that it's all going to come back to that moment in time where I, as the human being, knowing the path of left or right, right versus wrong, and I have to make a choice, I can make a choice, and I make a choice, and it is the choice that destroys. At the end of this story, when that house came down, there was nobody to blame except the fool that built without a foundation. It was his own dumb fault. Except that in life, we're not dumb. We're stubborn and rebellious, and that is different than dumb. And what Jesus is teaching here is a very serious crossroads, and he calls every one of us to it. And he says, if you don't go at the right way on the cross, not only will your house fall flat, I'm telling you this story to point out that spiritually your house will fall flat when I meet you. And I'll look at you and I'll say, you never did what you were supposed to do. I don't know you. And it's a horrific thing. And I just look at this capacity that I have to stand all clothed with truth. I fully comprehend Justin's devotions of how we dress up in this armor. But there are men and women that have been dressed up in the armor, and they have taken the dart to the heart in some fashion, on a spiritual level, because they never made the simple decision to raise up that shield or something like that. And so it, all of a sudden, something so familiar and so basic that even the children can look at it and understand is something that you and I have to come back to again and again. And we say, so what's the quality of my own obedience? And do I do it? Our failures, particularly us as a people that have been exposed to traditional truth, most of our failures are not ignorance. A few are deception, but most are simply rebellion. And he calls us back to make this decision. Now let's look at this story, because the story is going to help us. It's going to enlarge our understanding. looking at verse 24, if you hear and do, you're like a wise man who builds his house upon a rock. Let's go through this story and let's look at three things that are common to both sides. The commonality, number one, is that both men build houses. Not one man building a house, but several, and in real life it's many. But there's multiple houses being built, and what he's portraying by saying that you have this man building a house and this man building a house, what he's saying is that there's a lot of houses being built, and we judge it to be that everybody's building a house. And I think I can lift out scriptures that'll show that to you. We'll look at that in a minute. But number two, and flip over to Luke 6. I just want you to know the parallel scripture. I don't think either of these recordings are word for word what Jesus said, and that is why they don't all say the same thing. But he says in Luke chapter 6, verse 48, that the man built a house, he dug deep, he laid the foundation on a rock, and the flood arose, and the stream beat vehemently and could not shake it, for it was founded upon a rock. And then the second man is go over there, and he's building, and he's building on the same plane. It's not that the one was up at the top of the hill on Huntington Furnace Road, and the other one is down here on Park Street beside Bald Eagle Creek. But they're building at the same place. And so when the river overflowed, it nailed them both. Okay? And when the storm came in, it wasn't like Warrior's Mark got hit, but Altoona got missed. These were houses side by side, built on the same plane, facing the same storm, facing the same river, dealing with the same vehement flood. And that leads me to my third common point, and that is the houses are subject to the same spectrum of experience. Whether it's rain, wind, stream, or flood, it is going to be the same for both houses. And the tragedy of the crash is not in the environment, it's in the integrity of the house itself. So you want to think about that. That's the point Jesus is making. It's not the environment that causes the crash, it's the integrity of the structure itself. Now, how does this story meet the real parallels of life? Well, I told you, every man is building. You go to 1 Corinthians 3, I thought about turning to it. Do you know that by memory? Enough of what 1 Corinthians 3 is talking about. That 1 Corinthians 3 verses 10 to about 17 is where Paul is explaining how you build churches. But what he does there is he starts out talking about preachers and how they start groups and where they plant a new church and how this will grow and it'll get tested by fire. Until he's done, he switches the language into personal and he says, now let every man so build on the Lord Christ Jesus. And it almost seems like in the midst of that, he shifts his either his tense or his person, and he goes into everybody's building a house. We're not just preachers or the ministers or the missionaries are building a church, but rather that that everyone is building. Now everybody see that you build, because your work is going to get tested by fire. And I know that that is true. It is true of you and I. You're building, so am I. Nobody ever gets done. In the context of the story, the house is worked on until the storm comes, and the storm is the end of the story. Okay? And in that parallel, we start to see that he's talking about a life lived, and he's also talking about a time at the end where every man stands before the judgment seat of Christ. So every man is building. And there's two kinds of builders in this story, the wise and the foolish. And it doesn't mean that if you're rich, you're wise, and if you're poor, you're foolish. It doesn't mean if you're strong, you're good, and if you're weak, you're bad. It simply comes down to the wisdom of whether or not you will put a foundation under your house. And the whole time I'm studying for this, I'm remembering the garage I built back there along Main Street back in the 90s. If any of you remember where we lived there along 422, we built a nice story and a half garage, and it's still standing there, at least it was the last time I went up 422, but there is no foundation under that garage. We built that whole thing on a floating pad. We dug out, And we put a bunch of crushed stone in, and then we poured a floating concrete pad, and we just fastened the garage right down onto it. It's probably 16 or 17 feet tall. It has a 10-foot ceiling, has attic trusses, and we had steps up in there, and there it is. I guess I was a fool. Now, the only difference is that garage will never see a flood like is described here. Well, if it does, all of Marshtown's going to be underwater, if you knew where that property sat. It probably sat a good, from the Tulpehocken Creek, it probably sat a good 125, 150 feet higher than the closest river, creek. And so I don't know that it's ever going to get tested by flood. Wind maybe on that hill. But here was the man who built without a foundation. And he's a fool for doing that. And we understand enough about building that if you don't put something down on the rock, it's going to be a problem. And there's two kinds of people in this story, and that is the wise and the foolish. And the difference is whether or not you put a foundation. Now, every man builds in the same neighborhood, in the same plane. I make it to be that in this construction project, the wise and the foolish man could look across the rooftops at each other. They were right there. It's all the same. And everybody is building. There's no unemployment in this project. You know, Matthew 25 talks about this, the king that gave out the talents to everybody. And there was a man in that story that chose unemployment. He took it, wrapped it in a towel, and just buried it. And that was his plan. But in the house building project, there's no unemployment. We don't bury our talent. It's just a question of what kind of house are you building, am I building? And then every man's house, the storm will test. I went to these verses because this is basic life principle. But 2 Corinthians chapter 5, one of the favorite passages of Brother Raymond High, he would speak of it often, and we read it at his funeral. Wherefore, verse 9, we labor that whether present or absent, we may be accepted of him. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that every one may receive the things done in his body, according to that he hath done, whether it be good or bad. Every man is going to face the storm, the flood, the vehement wind is going to come in for every man, every woman, and they will know when it happens. So let's just step back and let's just think about a couple of things that the story ought to tell us. Number one, is that good intentions don't put in good foundations. Jesus told this story because he was trying to get us to think about people that go through the motions of obeying him but never get it done. He said, but you never did my will. You never did it. They said, well, we prophesied in your name. That is to foretell the future, to be intrigued by the future, to predict the future, to be hyper-focused on future events over everyday duties. And I've seen this happen, and I know that it's possible to get so focused on what may happen ahead of us that we diminish what we ought to be doing right now. And it's one of the dangers of getting caught up in studying future events. It's not wrong, it's actually wise. But if you overdo it, you'll become a prophet and not a simple man building a house. In your name, they said in verse 22, we did many wonderful works. One of the things that is intriguing to me is that there is such a thing in life as philanthropy, which is simply a wealthy or well-to-do person who takes their wealth and they go and they do it, they distribute it out to poor people, to destitute people, to impoverished people, to underprivileged people. One of the uncomfortable hallmarks of philanthropy as it is practiced today is the trumpet that goes with it. Look what I am doing. Could we get NBC to take a video and do a feature piece on me? And people would say they don't want it, but they're not opposed to having it done for them. And it ends up being, if you compare that to Christ, who would heal people and say, now you just go home and don't tell everyone, you just go home and work, follow me. And he would charge these people that. Well, he's looking for people that do, not people that tell. and make a lot of sound. Knowledge does not equate to performance. You know, there is so many things that we can know. But at the end of the day, when you back up into the Sermon on the Mount, you will have principles taught. Here's a powerful one. Go about to middle of chapter 6, where he's teaching the disciples how to pray. And he says, now when you pray, I want you to say that you are willing to forgive other people so that God will forgive you. And he ties it. Now the person that is going to value performance, well, that's probably a dangerous word. Doing, I'll use Jesus' words, doing over knowing is going to come face to face with that reality that there are times, people, and places where I have to make the obedient decision to forgive just to go on. And that merciful release that we have the capacity to extend because we decided to and no other reason. As far as I know, forgiveness doesn't have a reason other than we're supposed to and we decided to. I don't know that there's another reason to forgive. It's simply a mercy that we, because God has touched our hearts, we give it to other people and we are supposed to pray. And when you start talking at the end of this sermon about how we want to be way more than speakers or thinkers, but doers, right there it's going to get nitty gritty. It's going to get very personal. And if you want to build a house with a foundation, your life will be tracked in the choices to forgive. This is real life. Who of us hasn't been hurt? Who of us hasn't been offended? Which one of us didn't get what we thought was coming, or at least it was less than it was supposed to be? Or worse yet, where it was violently taken from us. And Jesus teaches that if you're going to be mine when the storm comes, you're going to have a foundation. Learn to forgive. Okay, that's where knowledge does not equate to performance, but rather performance still is ahead after we receive the knowledge. You go to chapter 6, verse 19, where he starts to say, now don't you dare lay up for yourself treasures on earth. That would be do not do that. As in, don't do that. Okay? That is not, what he says there is not, don't do it as much as you do other things. He's saying don't do it. And if you want to know what obedience is, you have to look and say, so where is my treasures and what am I accumulating and what is my defense for the accumulation? This is what Jesus taught. And at the end, he says, and so, whoso doeth the sayings of mine, but lay up treasures in heaven where moth and rust do not corrupt. He also tells us in that passage that you're not supposed to worry about the future, what you shall eat or what you shall drink. And this cuts across the human grain. It feels so right to be concerned. Well, you're welcome to be concerned. But if you're taking thought, then you've crossed the line. And he says, don't do it. And if we obey him, we somehow split that out and know the difference. Well, here's another thing to think about. So we go back to this story of a man that's building a house and he skips the foundation. Why did I skip a foundation on that garage up there on 422? I can tell you the reasons. It saved money. I didn't have to do as much excavation. I didn't have to get a mason in there to pour that concrete and set up the block wall before we poured the concrete. It saved money. It also saved time. And it wasn't necessary. At least that's what I thought, and that's what the man who helped me build, who was a builder, said, sure, you can do that. And I knew we could because I had done it several times on the job already. I don't know if you could do it anymore. I don't think the building codes would let you do that anymore. At least in most municipalities, most townships, you'd have to demonstrate that there will be a foundation. But why would a man skip a foundation? Well, I know one thing. When it comes to not obeying or why people skip foundations, sometimes it's nothing more. And this is a big one. It's that it's just too hard. I've helped put a few foundations in my time. The very hardest one was Jonas Goods over there on Hargill Road. He bought that rock pile off his brother, and he built a house on it. Now, if you're going to build on the rock, Jonas could have skipped a basement, because that was one solid chunk of rock. They didn't even put, on the one side of the house, they just made it all driveway, because you couldn't even put, well, you could have put a couple inches of dirt, but when I walked in there with the builder, I was working for a man in construction that did construction work, and we built that house. And the first time we walked in, we could not even drive stakes in for your, I don't know what you call them, corner posts you put in that you put your lines off. You couldn't even drive them in. We got a drill out and a generator, and we drilled holes in the rock to put steel rods in so we could set up our corners. And then after a while, the excavator came in, and he didn't have a backhoe. He had his dynamite rig, and he just blew that hole out. And now we're ready for a foundation, except that when we came in to pour the footers, we were going to put a concrete footer down on that rock and just give us a flat surface to start laying block on. When we came in there, we discovered that that one back corner was 4 inches too small. You couldn't get the house in the hole. And so me and another fellow spent a whole day. This is before the days of 18-volt Bosch hammer drills. We tried a jackhammer, but it was so big and heavy that it took two fellows, and how do you hang on to a plain old jackhammer? So we had an electric one, but finally we were just back to hammers and chisels, and we carved 4 inches of rock out of that one corner. You want to know why people skip foundations? It can be hard to put foundations in. And you know what else? There are people that are willing to throw in the towel on gospel obedience because it just is too hard. And don't be afraid. If the obedience of Christ is hard, that's normal. If a foundation goes in easy, it probably isn't a good one. That's what the man on the sand soon learned. But this other man was wise enough to know that below sand is bedrock. And that's where he went. And he dig deep, Jesus said. And you see the effort that is there. Is it worth it? Well, the truth is, obeying is hard. You look at when he teaches about lust. I think people fall for it because it is a tasty apple. Well, what about the whole thing of love and versus revenge in Matthew 5? 43 to 48, love those who don't even love you back. This is how you put a foundation in, and it's hard. Have you ever tried loving somebody that you know can't stand you? Have you tried? Can you do it? Are we supposed to do it? Now that's the key. The answer is yes, you're supposed to do it, because that's one of the sayings of Jesus. Love those who do not love you back. And those who despitefully use you, you pray for them. This is the gospel way, and this is how you put in a foundation. Why do people skip foundations? Well, it's hard. It's too hard. But the other reason that I know people skip foundations is because it's too invisible. Back in the 90s, I was at a big Holiday Inn, and they had their own well, and they had a terrible iron problem, and it kept staining things. And they had a water system there, and it was not working. And I was there to either fix it or come up with a solution that worked. And I asked the man why they left this thing get in such dilapidated shape. I said, this thing should have been repaired a long time ago, not today. I mean, it was so broken. I didn't, you know, some of the housings were all corroded off and pinholes spraying out of them. They had it all shut off. And he said, well, you're right, it should have been fixed a long time ago, but he said, it's awfully hard to get management to spend money where people can't see you. I said, you mean they'd rather spend $15,000 on the chandelier in the foyer than $15,000 on the water system out back? He said, exactly. You know why people don't put in foundations? That's money spent where you can't see you. And so many times, when you look through the Sermon on the Mount, a lot of these little guidance commands that Jesus gives, they're going to be done in a world where the rest of people really don't see what's going on. And we have this itch that we want to do things that are noticed. Maybe I'm the only one that ever gets that itch. But we default to wanting to do things that people see. it just seems like that's the smarter place to put your time. Sell a lot so that you can work your way up the list. That's one that I face. Come on, let's see if you can hit 1,000. We'll give you the banner. And we want to put our time where it's noticed. And foundations aren't noticed. You just know if they're missing, because the cracks appear and bad things start to happen. Well, I would just like to observe that the uncovering of disobedience at the end is as catastrophic as a house crash. How many of you saw the church that fell over down here at East Freedom? I don't know what they're going to do. I went past that this week again. I asked Sean, I said, what are they going to do with that? I don't know. That is a mess. I mean, they started building that big extension onto the side of that sanctuary, and the house beside the church went crash, and there it lays. And somebody is going to spend a lot of time and a lot of money starting over. The crash is horrific. But you know, the crash of that foolish man's house was something you don't walk back from. When that house went down, it was over. Because the house went down at the judgment scene is what happened. And you don't walk back from that. The only thing left, when you look at a house that fell flat, Jesus' words are, depart from me. You never knew you. Go away. You're not mine. We are not together. Out. And there is no walking back. Somebody's going to figure out a way to clean up that mess at East Freedom. But this one, when the house on the sand fell flat, it was down. And that's what makes it so serious. Jesus was not just telling a funny little story or a horrific one of a church that fell over while it was being built and somebody's got to figure out how to build it back up. He was telling a story about a house that can never be brought back. And that makes it pretty serious. Actually, it makes it more serious than most anything else in the world. Because you can't walk back from it. Well, what's the conclusion? Number one, Jesus is calling for me to put a foundation, and he's calling for compliance, cooperation, obedience. What word do you understand the best? I say something, you do it. He's actually calling for exactly the standard that God held his son to. God spoke, Jesus did. Whoso heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them. That's what Christ is calling for. Put your foundation in. And when you cooperate with my teachings and you do it my way, as I am instructing, as I am calling, your house will stand the flood. Don't worry about it. Matter of fact, don't worry at all. Whosoever heareth and doeth, whosoever doeth, it is a third person present archaic. It just simply means that it is performance. It is to carry out that which is dispensed for duty. Go and do, you say to the child. And all you're asking for, if the do is relation to gathering all the dishes off the kitchen table and stacking them in the dishwasher or getting the trays out and filling the vats, all mom is asking for is that the dishes get moved off the table, put over on the sink, the water tubs filled, and when they are finished, they are done, and they have did. That's all Jesus is asking for. Do. Do. Don't come up with an excuse. Don't think about what would be more fun. Don't think about what else you could do that people would see instead of what they don't see. Jesus is simply calling for doing. And Jesus is not interested in people that say they're going to do and people that bear testimony that they are doing. He's simply looking for dishes that get done. Please understand that noncompliance has a tragic end. We had that wild storm the other night, and I was already thinking about this passage. And I don't know how bad it was at your house. It seemed to be one of the worst that we've endured since we moved into this area. But I was standing there, and I saw a branch break off of a tree. And it was like in a moment, everything was arranged. It just happened. and there was no stopping it. Why some trees stood and one side some trees came down, I don't know. I know that some power lines came down because trees came down with a chop on them, tore them, and the sparks flew, and we were out of power. But there's something about the swiftness of destruction in a storm that is awesome. And it's the same way when people get to the end of life and they stand before their Maker, there is a judgment, and it is a moment, and it's there. And Jesus is saying, start thinking and doing today so that when you stand before me, well, the storms will beat, the floods will come, and you will be examined in fine detail, and it'll be just fine because you have a foundation. You know that obedience is not as difficult as it feels when it's time to do it. We are actually programmed people to be obedient. You were born to obey. And we spend the rest of our lives listening to voices that come into our minds. And the hard question is discerning what the voices are and whether we're listening to the right one or not. Even the man that breaks every one of Jesus' commandments is not doing it because his head is empty. He's doing it because he's listening to another voice. And that actually does really simplify life. When it all boils down, there's a simple crossroad. Will he, will she obey? It comes down to that simple moment of what is Dwayne going to do? And that's one of the things that I thought about with these sad stories of some of people's failures that I've had to relate to recently. Is you even when you listen to them tell their stories, and they can see it after it's all over, but right through that whole process, it's easy to spot the crossroads where if you'd have just done the other thing, we wouldn't be here. And it's hard for me to believe sometimes that obedience is so simple, that it comes down to simply yes or no. Will I or won't I? We put a lot of chaff around it, and we start thinking things like, well, I won't, but then I will. In other words, I'm going to take this liberty. Okay, you go into something like eating. I'll just eat this and tomorrow I'll diet. But you can't play that game when you're digging foundations. I'll just do this thing that I feel like doing today, but tomorrow I will live different. And the really arrogant people are the ones that think they can listen to whatever voice they want to today and they'll change for tomorrow and Jesus will accept them anyway. I've heard people say things that sounded like that, and they probably shouldn't even think that way because it's not true, and there's a terrible reaping for that sowing. Well, every man's building a house. God bless you as you build. Let's kneel for